Carla Peterson began a quest to reconstruct the lives of her 19th century ancestors with a single name, her great-grandfather, Philip Augustus White. Her search quickly grew beyond her own family into a discovery of the social history of the so-called black elites of the 19th century here in New York, which she has documented in a book called Black Gotham, A Family History of African Americans in 19th Century New York. It's published by Yale University Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Good to be here.
I don't think I've ever known the names of any of my great-grandparents. How did you know of Philip Augustus White? Did your family talk much about its history?
No, not at all. And that was a big problem that I faced when I started the book. But they did talk about him. And they gave me a story about him, which turned out to be totally false. Or not totally, but semi-false. That he was
So many family stories are.
Absolutely. So that he was born in Haiti as Philippe Auguste Blanc. At the time of the Haitian Revolution, emigrated to Paris, became a pharmacist, and then came to the United States, to New York, and changed his name, anglicized his name to Philip Augustus White.
And that was all totally wrong?
Not totally wrong. The Haiti part and the French part was wrong. But the name Philip Augustus Wright, New York, and pharmacy was accurate. So that was the one thing I had to go on.
Now, why were you doing this? I remember when Roots became a national phenomenon, almost everybody, white and black, from wherever, seemed to be researching his past. Is that what inspired you here?
Well, there was a double motivation. First of all, professional. I'm a professor of African-American literary studies, and 19th century northern black culture is my field. So this was go on, find out more about your field. And then, of course, there was the personal motivation of to ask myself, well, who were my people? And I knew that they were somebodies, that they weren't nobody. And that made me just very curious. So it was a convergence of the two factors.
But you can't just type in Philip Augustus White on a Google search and come up with anything, can you?
Unfortunately not. And having White as a family name is just really made it impossible.
But it's almost as bad as Smith, isn't it?
Yes, or Brown or whatever. So I went to the Schomburg, which is, after all, our main resource here in New York City. And I started going through a collection of a woman who had written a book about free blacks in antebellum New York. It had come out in the 70s. And she'd left a collection, those shoeboxes, if you remember back to that time. And in box number 8 under biography, I found 2 obituaries, one of my great-grandfathers, so I recognized the name Philip Augustus White, and right behind it, a man named Peter Guignon. And he turned out to be my great-great-grandfather. Philip Augustus married his daughter.
And he was from the West Indies.
He was the West Indian. He was the Haitian.
Now, why did his family come to New York? I didn't realize there was that kind of immigration that early.
Oh, there was, because of the Haitian Revolution. So you have one family that's in the historical record, the Berard family, were slave-holding whites, and they came to the United States, to New York, and settled in New York and are famous because of Pierre Toussaint, their slave, who became a very well-known hairdresser. So you had slaveholding whites escaping and bringing their slaves with them.
Well, you write that you recall your family talking of a white Haitian when you were a child.
Yes, and I'm still not sure who that is. It could have been Peter Guignon's father, which would have been my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather. It could have been Peter Guignon himself, who was very light-skinned. I just don't know anything about Peter Guignon's parents. I'm surmising that his father was white. He must have been, because his name comes up in connection with the Berard family, and his mother must have been a black woman.
Although there are different changing values applied to skin color over the history of the world. Somebody might have been called white at one time, black at another time. We kept on changing the rules. So it probably made the research even more complicated. And then you discovered, after you were searching for Peter Guignon's father, you found his in-laws, Elizabeth Hewlett Marshall and Joseph Marshall, And that was through the story of a man named George Lorillard?
Not quite.
Okay.
So it was through the story of a man by the name of Harry Elbro Williamson. So I'm back at the Schomburg doing a second go-through on papers, and I find the Harry Elbro Williamson papers, and I start looking through it. And there he's writing about his family, and he says, Rebecca Marshall, she was Peter Guignon's first wife. And so that's how I found out my great-great-great-grandparents.
So how much can you find out about them other than their names and perhaps where they lived at the time?
That is the big, big problem. We can do genealogy, get names, but the question is, how do we create stories or how do we find the stories? Names are just lists, and the really, really hard thing is to find stories to tell about them.
But people were also writing about what was going on in New York at the time. Could you just put two and two together?
That's what you have to do. So one of the kind of overriding metaphors of the book is the idea of the scrap, that the obits came from a scrapbook, that Harry Elbro Williamson's papers are like a scrapbook. And what you have to do is take scraps of paper and put them together. So a lot of the information I found out, or at least some of it, came from black newspapers, the Freedom's Journal and the Colored American. Another way is to go through white institutions. The Colored Orphan Asylum was led by white women, but they took care of colored children. So go to that, to their documents, see whether they refer to blacks. So those are two ways, at least, in which you can get at some of this information.
My guest is Carla L. Peterson. Her book, Black Gotham, A Family History of African Americans in 19th Century New York City, published by Yale University Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Carla L. Peterson, who's written Black Gotham, A Family History of African Americans in 19th Century New York City, published by Yale University Press. A lot of your research refers back to the memoirs of Maricha Lyons. How was she related to you?
She is my great-grand-aunt.
How did you discover that?
By going through the Harry Elbro Williamson papers, because her memoir is in those papers, and he refers to her. He has a family tree, and she is his aunt. So I was able to reconstruct the family that way.
Was that a published memoir?
No, it isn't. It's typescript, about 85 pages, pretty much in draft form. The organization isn't perfect, and it's a type manuscript in the Schomburg collection.
She became the assistant principal at PS 83 in Brooklyn.
Yes.
Was that simply because of her status as a member of the Black elite?
Yes, definitely. So she is a fascinating example of one of the few black women that I was able to trace in the book. Before the Civil War, I could find very, very little on black women. But she is born in New York, goes through the experience of the draft riots, the family leaves, she comes back. The family settles in Brooklyn, and she, in her memoir, she talks about being taught by two of the great black New York educators of the time, Charles Reason, who went to school with my great-great-grandfather, Peter Guignon, and a whole bunch of other young men who become very important, and also John Peterson. So she is schooled by them and is then able to enter into the public school system in New York.
But it's obvious that there's a stratified class system within the black community. Did they think of themselves as the black elite? Is that what they called themselves?
Well, they called themselves a black aristocracy.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
And went to the same church?
They went to the same school. So I begin by talking about the school, by this group of young men, as young men, Peter Guignon and all of his friends, Charles Reason, Patrick Reason, James McCune Smith, Alexander Crummell, who all go on to become really eminent black leaders of the 19th century. And many of them went to the same church, which was St. Philip's Episcopal Church.
And they were members of the same societies, the Phoenix Society and the Philomathian Society.
Absolutely. Those were the literary societies that they started.
What were they? What was their goal, these societies?
It was twofold. One was to get together and continue to educate and improve themselves through reading, giving talks, and so forth. And the other was an outreach to the Black community, to what they saw as the less advanced or less prosperous members of the community, inviting them to come in and learn. And it's a program that we now call Racial Uplift, and that has come in for a certain amount of controversy as seen as condescending elitist. But the way I look at racial uplift is, yes, the improvement of the masses, but also self-improvement.
But almost every immigrant group in America did something similar. So why is it patronizing among African-Americans and not among Jews or Italians or the Irish or whatever?
The question of class in
Koreans
the
more recently and
yes,
Chinese.
Yes, absolutely. But the whole question of class, I think, is still a vexed one in the Black community. We want to see ourselves as the Black community as opposed to Black communities.
What about the role of women? Were women allowed to join the Phoenix Society and the Philomathian Society?
No. They went accompanied by their spouses or boyfriends, as it were. It was a night out for the ladies, but the participation was definitely male. So I found one small example of a ladies' society in the antebellum period, and that was the Ladies' Literary Society. It existed for maybe 3 years. One of the Black men, George Downing, says it had only a ghostly existence. Women were really not part of this, or don't seem to be part of this very active, vibrant cultural life.
Although you did find anonymous letters from a woman named Charlotte Kay that were written to Frederick Douglass's paper talking about the men's literary societies.
Yes. So she, in the 1850s, she publishes this letter. We don't know who she is. And she looks back on her years in the 1840s in New York City and talks about how the Philomathian and the Phoenixonian societies were great societies that welcomed women to go to their activities and so forth. And then come along the Freemasons and the Odd Fellows. And that's the beginning of the end for women being able to participate, because these were all male societies that absolutely locked out women. But the one thing I want to emphasize is, to get a little academic, there's a critic who distinguishes between two kinds of silences: the silence of the sources and the silence of the archives. So one, the silence of the sources would be, were women not there at all? Were they just at home, or were they there? But we don't, and that would be the silence of the sources. The silence of the archives is they were there, but their activities were not recorded and not preserved.
What do you think?
I think probably a mix of the two, because the fact is that in Boston and in Philadelphia, Black women are there, and their presence is felt and recorded.
Now, there seems to be an awful lot of confusion because there's always confusion over race. You mentioned Philip Augustus White being Philippe Auguste Blanc, perhaps. It turns out not to be true. But then there's the story of Joseph Marshall, one of your ancestors, who was from Maracaibo, Venezuela. Would he have been seen as Hispanic or as a Negro at the time?
He would have been seen as non-white. So the way I look at it, either you're white or you're not white, or you could possibly, if you were not mixed, you could possibly be, you would then be labeled as African. But he would fall in the category of non-white, as did so many of the people that I look at. And they would also come under the category of African or colored.
But would he have been accepted into the African American community?
Oh, he was. Absolutely.
Was his name Joseph Marshall, really, or was that an Americanization?
I'm guessing that it was an Americanization. But there were so many like him who are not pure white, so they become non-white and then colored American, African, whatever name you want to call it.
And they were living in Lower Manhattan, not in Harlem.
Right. So Harlem at the time was a small little village. I came across an article that called it a dwarf to New York, written by a black man in the 1850s.
Well, it wasn't yet a part of New York City.
Right, exactly. And so the guy was going up the river and or going to Harlem and saying, I've gotten to this small village, et cetera. So, yes, Peter Guignol, Philip White, and all of their friends were in Lower Manhattan.
Were they integrated into the society, or was there segregation?
So there was not segregation the way we think of it. So they were lumped in certain neighborhoods in the Sixth Ward, around what was called Five Points, over by in Greenwich Village, or towards the East River. So they lived in clumps and neighborhoods, but within that, they were surrounded by white people. Segregation was very often block by block or within a block. I'm not saying that they all lived together in one building, but they were cheek by jowl, shoulder by shoulder in Lower Manhattan.
And this is a time when there was still slavery in the area.
Slavery existed in New York until 1827.
So were they seen as uniquely different, or were they seen as – I mean, I guess there was this another kind of a split within the black community, slaves,
yes.
Freed people,
yes.
And the elite.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And so 1827 marked very big – was a big change, although I suspect that there were not that many slaves in the 1820s. But the idea of emancipation in 1827 was a very, very significant marker.
What elements of black elite culture did you find beginning in the downtown area at this time? Was theater starting to develop? Was there a specific approach to music that was different from everybody else's?
Well, we had the literary societies, the Philomathian Society, the Phoenixonian Society. There was also a theater, the African Grove Theater, which received quite a bit of notoriety. A man by the name of William Brown started it. My great-great-great-granduncle was an actor there. His name was James Hewlett, and he was run out of the family because they thought that his acting was very disrespectful. So he played Othello. He played Richard III, many different parts. He got a lot of press, some of it good, some of it not good. Some of the people in the white press mocked his accent and so forth. But that theater created so much competition with white theaters that there was a riot, and the theater was forced to close down.
Before the Civil War, were blacks allowed to vote?
Oh, that's a big question. Blacks were allowed to vote up until 1821, and then there was an amended constitution that instituted a poll tax, basically that you had to be able to make a certain amount of money in order to be able to vote.
So with the end of slavery, we wind up then denying people the right to vote.
Right, exactly. So that happens in 1821. 1827 is the end of slavery, but black men who were able to vote cannot. And that became, unlike Boston and Massachusetts, this became one of the really big issues for black New Yorkers, getting back the right to vote, which men, black men in Massachusetts had the entire time.
And when did that change?
It changed with emancipation. Mm. Yeah.
There was also the African free school system. Was that a segregated system?
Yes, absolutely. It was started by the New York Manumission Society, a society created to emancipate slaves. And at the same time, they thought, we want slaves emancipated, but we also want them educated. And so they started this school system, the African Free Schools for Young Black Men and Women. And so the school that was most famous is the school that my great-great-grandfather Peter Guignol went to, along with all these other men whose names I've mentioned.
And these were supported by whites.
Yes.
So there was a fair amount of racial mixing at the time.
Yes,
socializing.
There was. Socializing, maybe not, but there was. One of the things that happens, though, with something like a benevolent society like the African Free School is what I call the benevolent contract at one point. So these white philanthropists give money, but they have expectations in return. They want humility. They want gratitude. They want stay in your place. So benevolence can be seen kind of as a mixed blessing.
The Civil War tore New York City apart. Did it have an effect on the black elite?
Oh, absolutely. The draft riots affected the black elite as much as any other part of black society. And I talk about the way in which the black elite keeps on hoping that class will trump race. And the draft riots prove that wrong, that does not happen.
Were they more likely to support one party over the other? I'd assume when the Republicans came along because of Abraham Lincoln and the fact that the Democrats were really linked to the South and supported the slavery, that most new black voters would have been Republicans.
Most of them were indeed.
And that ended with FDR, I think, didn't it?
Well, yeah, but you have a few resistors. And much like we hear in the discourse of the 20th and 21st century, I can think of at least two instances where blacks say, so what has the Republican Party done for us lately? Not very much. So maybe we should rethink this blind support for the Republican Party. And it happens with a man like Robert Hamilton right at the time of the Civil War. And then in the 1880s and 1890s, when T. Thomas Fortune, George Downing, T. McCants Smith become black Democrats.
We have no time left, but was life different for black elites in Manhattan and in Brooklyn? Because your family was in both boroughs.
Yes. So after the Civil War, they move over to Brooklyn, and their fortunes are much improved. Once again, they live in a small community, but are much more moneyed and cultured better professional opportunities than before.
Carla Peterson will be giving a talk tonight at 6:30 at the CUNY Gotham Center at 5th Avenue and 34th Street. And on Monday, she'll be speaking at the Jefferson Market Library at 6:30. That's free, but reservations are required. The book, Black Gotham, is published by Yale University Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, I'll talk with the grandson of Lionel Loeb, the unorthodox speech therapist whose story is told in the Academy Award-nominated film The King's Speech. And then Jed Rothstein tells about his Oscar-nominated short documentary Killing in the Name, about a campaign by a Muslim victim of suicide bombers to change the minds of jihadis. Also, we will take a look at a new exhibit of Picasso's guitar works at MoMA. Find out about efforts to protect the planet from asteroids, plus Backstory looks at the rise and dictatorship of Muammar Gaddafi. The Let It Lopez Show is produced by Stephen Valentino, Julia Corcoran, Blakeney Schick, and Christina Maldonado. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Max Bass, Angela Sheldon, Jessica Miller, and contributing producer Robert Kahn. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Let It Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.